4 years ago, Barack Obama, then a 47-year-old U.S. senator from Illinois, told an estimated 84,000 people packed into a football stadium at the base of the Rocky Mountains that, among other things, he would change the face of healthcare in the United States if he were elected president.
Now is the time to finally keep the promise of affordable, accessible healthcare for every single American. If you have health care, my plan will lower your premiums. If you don't, you'll be able to get the same kind of coverage that members of Congress give themselves. And as someone who watched my mother argue with insurance companies while she lay in bed dying of cancer, I will make certain those companies stop discriminating against those who are sick and need care the most.
That was one of the many promises he made that last night of the Democratic National Convention in Denver in 2008. This year, voters will decide whether he kept that and enough other promises, whether his work as president will go forward with re-election or end in defeat. This week at the 2012 Democratic National Convention, Barack Obama and the Democratic Party will make the case for his re-election. Joining us now for a preview of the convention in Charlotte is Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau correspondent Jack Torrey. Welcome back to the show, Jack.
Glad to be with you, Ann.
Also in Charlotte, North Carolina, Howard Wilkinson, politics reporter for 91.7 WVXU in Cincinnati. Howard, welcome.
Good morning.
So we just heard Barack Obama from 4 years ago promising to reform health care in the United States. Jack Torrey, the topic will be key this week.
It will be one of the things, but actually what they're going to be trying to do more than anything else is, and the message is, there's a very compact message that's coming out of this, that's going to come out of this convention, that President Obama took over at the time of the worst economic performance since the Great Depression. That's a debatable fact, but no one can argue that the economy was in a disastrous shape in 2009. That he made a series of decisions that made the economy better, including the economic stimulus package of 2009 and the auto rescue of General Motors and Chrysler. He will talk about health care not in the sense of so much of what of the controversies about it and how much it will cost, but what you will lose if it's taken away, such as allowing parents allowing their children, I think up to the age of 26, to stay on their policies. And throughout this thing, they will say, look, this is not a complete turnaround, but you don't want to cut this off now. And so I think that's what you're going to see. And we've heard this from speaker after speaker, ranging from Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. It's the same theme. And reporters, you know, we can be a little bit dense, but even eventually it starts getting through to us.
Well, Howard Wilkinson, is it really about you guys?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we're carrying the message from Charlotte, and Jack is completely right. Every speaker, and I mean every speaker, is hitting on the same theme, and theme is certainly that the United States economy is a very large ship, and turning around a very large ship in the middle of the ocean is very difficult and takes a lot of time. They're arguing that they're in the middle of this process, that when Obama took office, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month, and they're making the claim that over the past 29 months, we've seen growth, modest though it may be, in job creation in the private sector.
We're talking with Howard Wilkinson, reporter for WVXU in Cincinnati, and also Jack Torrey of the Columbus Dispatch. They're both in Charlotte, North Carolina, covering the Democratic National Convention, which kicks off today. If you have a question or comment for them, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Jack, how you said it was a compact message, but how will they extrapolate on what he has achieved outside of the economic realm?
Well, there was a very interesting line that I first heard it from Vice President Biden, and then I heard it from Governor O'Malley yesterday. And Howard is right. When they start repeating things over and over and over again, they're trying to tell us the message. It's not all geared to the reporters, because tonight at 10 o'clock, the entire country will be able to hear the same message. But I'm trying to remember exactly how he put it, but he said, you know, General Motors is alive and hiring. Osama bin Laden is not. The economy is adding jobs, maybe not enough jobs as possible. But it's all a, you know, it's going to be a very, very tight message if they're successful. And I'm looking for that actual quote. For the life of me, I can't find it. It was a wonderful
one. That's a good one, though, the one that you said.
Well, where unemployment is down, job creation is up, General Motors is alive and hiring, and Osama bin Laden is not. You're going to hear a variation on that theme, if not the exact same line, over and over and over again.
Howard Wilkinson, how does Barack Obama, I guess, turn away from the negative campaigning that's been the hallmark of both sides of the coin so far, and looking forward to giving a positive look at his presidency? How do you change that mood?
Well, he's walking a very fine line here. I mean, you know, so far it has been a very negative message, and it's been a negative message about Romney and Ryan wanting to take the country back to failed economic policies of the Bush administration. But he really does have to lay out a plan, an idea, and that's the one thing we haven't heard is, okay, we're going to go forward, but what is forward? What does it mean? What do we do next in order to kickstart this economy again and get jobs growing at a faster rate? That's the thing that he has, the message that he has to deliver here.
Jack, I was wondering, does forward mean something different when you're an incumbent versus when you're the challenger?
Well, it does in this sense. First of all elections are about tomorrow as opposed to today, if you're successful. Bill Clinton was the master of this in the 1996 race against Bob Dole. He turned it into a yesterday versus tomorrow with his reference to the bridge of the 21st century. I have no idea what that meant, but it sounded good. And you're seeing that today. It's forward, not backwards. Don't go back to 2008 when the Republicans were in charge and they gave us this catastrophic financial meltdown. Go forward with where we're going. You may not like the progress we're making at the speed we're making, but it is progress. And that's the theme they're going to be doing. But to make an election about the future, you also have to tell people what you're going to do. And so far, what the Obama campaign has done, they've essentially lifted a page from the Bush reelection campaign in 2004. It has been trying to make the issue Mitt Romney's unacceptable. It's a very hard thing for an incumbent to do because you've been in charge for the past 4 years and you've got to tell people what are you going to do in the next four.
Without sounding like you failed to do something in the last four.
Exactly. And they're threading that needle in this way. They're saying, look, you may not like all the progress we've been making. But it is progress. Nobody can deny that. There's been about 4.5 million new jobs created in the past 4 years. And it's, as Howard said earlier, when they took office in 2009, the country was losing about 700,000 jobs a month. So you can make the progress. Now, my own judgment is it has less to do with who's in the White House and more to do with the national, international, financial, and U.S. Economic system, which sort of operates to its own speed. But the fact of the matter, any incumbent is credited with what happens on his or her watch and is blamed for what happens badly on his or her watch.
Howard, 4 years ago, they were running against John McCain. But listening back to a lot of the speeches over the last couple of days, I got the sense they were always respectful of him, of his military service and his work as a longtime U.S. senator. Will they take the gloves off for Mitt Romney? Will they behave differently as the convention rolls out?
Well, they are taking the gloves off, and they're essentially saying, and particularly against Paul Ryan and the speech that he made at the convention in Tampa, and saying that he lied, he told untruths, he said things that simply are not the case, and there is going to be a lot of that, but I think it's going to be mostly from the surrogates and not from President Obama himself. You might hear Vice President Biden in his speech go after Romney much, much harder than the president does in his acceptance speech.
Jack?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what you're trying to do with a an incumbent is you're trying to let the surrogates, you know, bloody up the opponent, and then the incumbent try to use the acceptance speech to draw a contrast, and then end on a more of an uplifting note. And there have been speeches like that have worked in that regard. Roosevelt's 1936 acceptance speech is one of the best, and it's actually somewhat similar to what the challenge Obama faces. Roosevelt took office in the midst of the Great Depression, and by 1936, the economy was making a recovery, but it wasn't a huge recovery. Unemployment was way, way high. But in his speech, he talked about how Americans had – he concluded with a great line, the Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. Nowhere in that speech, by the way, does he mention Alf Landon or the Republican Party or anything about the Republicans. Instead, he talks about the economic royalists going who want to control your life. And it was a very, very effective speech. My guess is the Obama people have looked at that speech pretty carefully. So what they're going to try and do is end up on some sort of an uplifting note on Thursday night that simultaneously fires up their own base, and while getting those handful of independents in Ohio and Virginia and North Carolina and Florida who will decide the election.
Say, Howard Wilkinson, is there any intrinsic difference, in your opinion, between the Democrat and Republican conventions across, you know, throughout, you know, through as many as you have been to, outside of whether or not the candidate is the challenger or the incumbent? Do they differ in mood at all in general?
Well, I mean, they differ in tone. I mean, obviously, Romney was trying to put Obama on the defensive, and Obama is, you know, out there trying to make an argument, which is hard to make, that things have improved and can get better if you only give me a chance. And that's a much harder argument to make, and it's one that he's going to have to pull off on Thursday night in order to come out of this thing with any kind of a bounce.
So, Jack, the spirit is pretty much driven by whether you're a challenger or an incumbent.
Oh yeah, I always think if you're a challenger, I mean if the challengers think you can win, I mean there's a lot of enthusiasm. I think that's what your question was driving at.
Mm-hmm. A party thing, in other words.
No, yeah. There was a if you compare, for example, the 1992 Democratic convention. The enthusiasm out of that place was overwhelming because they finally thought they had a chance to end 12 years of Republican rule. So you're seeing a lot of it. You're seeing it in the delegate every morning. The Ohio delegation is holding a breakfast, mm-hmm. and they're bringing in speakers. And today, I'm still recovering from this. Ashley Judd, the actress, was there, and everybody applauded. I'm trying to remember what she said, but she sure looks good.
Right.
Well, thanks for sharing that. Jack Torrey, you're going to stay with us and regale us with more stories from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. Howard Wilkinson, we have to say goodbye to you, though. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure, anytime. Thank you.
Howard Wilkinson, politics reporter for 91.7 WVXU in Cincinnati. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Neil Conan, host of Talk of the Nation. We hope you'll listen for live coverage of breaking news as it happens, for expert analysis that's insightful, balanced, and engaging. And we hope you'll call to join the conversations about the topics on everybody's mind. For all that and more, listen to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 75 degrees with rain likely today, maybe a thunderstorm this afternoon, a high of 81. Still a chance of rain for tonight, a low of 68. Some fog for Wednesday morning, then partly sunny and a high of 88 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners, investment managers, providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life, at sherringtongroup.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Four years ago, Barack Obama made his case at the Democratic National Convention in Denver, where he was officially nominated for the Democratic presidential ticket. One of the issues in his speech, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
You don't defeat a terrorist network that operates in 80 countries by occupying Iraq. You don't protect Israel and deter Iran just by talking tough in Washington. You can't truly stand up for Georgia when you've strained our oldest alliances. If John McCain wants to follow George Bush with more tough talk and bad strategy, that is his choice, but that is not the change that America needs.
All right, so everybody knows it's the economy, stupid, no doubt, but to what extent does President Obama reiterate his record on the issue of war and the military? Joining us, still with us, to talk about that, Jack Torrey, correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Washington Bureau. Jack, once again, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Also, political scientist John C. Green at the University of Akron. John, welcome back to the show. Hi, John.
Hi.
So what about military? What about the wars? Pretty much at the Republican National Convention, that wasn't dealt with very much at all, except for maybe the John McCain speech.
Well, you know, I don't think that foreign policy will be a major component of the Democratic Convention, but I think it will get mentioned because President Obama can point to some real successes in the war against terrorism. Our troops are out of Iraq. He has a plan to get the troops out of Afghanistan. So I think that's one way that the president can sell his record, is to talk about these foreign policy successes. But I think, as in Tampa, the focus really will be on the economy, which is what most people say is most important to them.
Jack Torrey?
Yes. Well, I think what he does with foreign affairs is he enters with an edge over Romney on this, because he at least has the experience of 4 years. He also ordered the killing of bin Laden. He ordered U.S. combat troops out of Iraq. He's trying to bring some sort of closure to the war in Afghanistan. But these issues are not going to decide this election.
Right.
Almost never do they do. The only election that I can think of in my lifetime in which foreign affairs decided it was the 1968 race between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey at the height of the Vietnam War. That was the overriding issue. The issue is the economy, the jobs. What are you going to do about this? And did this man keep his promises? And what does he plan to do for the next 4 years? And you have to contrast, and the voters are going to have to look at the contrasting plans offered by Governor Romney. And so that's where I think this will be decided. It's an advantage for a president not to go into an election with foreign affairs being a big problem. It's just not much of a factor.
So, John Green, how does Barack Obama top that speech from 4 years ago before 84,000 people in a stadium alone?
Boy, it's going to be difficult, and that's partly because, you know, whatever one's politics might be, that acceptance speech in 2008 was very magical. I mean, just a lot of things went right, both in the campaign and in political circumstances, and it's just going to be very difficult to duplicate. But I think the Obama team is going to work very hard to do that. We're going to have a similar setting with, a big crowd. And of course, the president is a very good public speaker, and I'm sure that he's honed that message. You know, one of the things that the president did in 2008 that he can do this year is to present a positive agenda. Now, campaigns always get caught up in, you know, criticism and some negativity and so forth, but the president needs to chart the path ahead, building on the successes this administration has had and turning towards the continuing problems. And I think he has just a great opportunity to lay out that agenda. But it will be tough to have as well-received speech as 4 years ago.
Yeah, Jack, the story of his life and ancestors and all of that is well known now. That was great fodder back in 2004 and again in 2008. But now it's pretty much his record as president.
Right. And he has to, and again, we know what the storyline is going to be. Nobody ever got handed a worse hand since FDR in 33. And here's what we've done. And it's not far enough, and we hasn't fast enough. But you don't want to go back to these other guys because, you know, they're coming up with all their, you know, the Democrats will say their crackpot schemes on the economy. So he will be doing that. His one problem actually could be logistical. He wants to deliver this at the Carolina Panthers outdoor football
stadium. I wondered if he wanted to do that again.
Yeah, he wants to do it again. And Denver was the perfect place to deliver a speech outdoors in August because there was no clouds in the sky. You don't see any sunshine here because it's just one thunderstorm after another.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they claim they're going to do this rain or shine, they're going to deliver outdoors, but I can't imagine a worse visual than having Barack Obama speaking to 75,000 delegates who are holding umbrellas and avoiding lightning. In fact, I was kidding one of their...
Or worse yet, just not there.
Yes, I was kidding one of their campaign guys yesterday. I said, can you imagine this headline? You know, 12 people killed by lightning as Obama accepts nomination.
You know, that is a really interesting point because, of course, the Republicans had some problems with Hurricane Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't turn out to be as difficult as some of them had worried about. And of course, it ended up causing some real problems in New Orleans. But, you know, the best plans of campaigns are often disrupted by things like the weather.
Yeah. Did either of you miss that day of the Republican National Convention, by the way?
I didn't attend. I only did. I'm doing the Democratic convention. I didn't do the Republican.
I know, but it just as a political.
Oh no,
you know.
I didn't miss it. You know what? I mean, okay. Here's the dirty little secret, and I'm hoping Ben Maris and my editor's not listening to this show today. But these things have really gotten obsolete. There's like, what's the purpose of this? There's no news. It's simply an infomercial. You know, I used the example of 68 earlier, and, you know, I was a teenager watching both the Democratic and Republican conventions. They actually nominated their candidates there. They had big floor fights that meant things.
Mm-hmm.
Today, that doesn't happen. Everything is controlled. Almost nothing happens that isn't scripted tightly. The Clint Eastwood empty chair thing is a glaring example of something that did happen that I don't think was scripted. But everything you're seeing here is a message, and it has nothing to do with what I would call actual news. And last week, John Boehner, the House Speaker, sort of wondered, you know, I don't know why we're holding these things for 3 or 4 days anymore.
Well, John Green, are they any value to the delegates, to the press? I mean, it's a gigantic schmooze fest, but is there any value to that? Eat too.
Well, you know, I didn't miss the first day of the convention at all.
Okay.
You know, and I did, you know, enjoy some of the speeches, and I thought the last day really did, you know, some positive things. And, of course, including the nominees' acceptance speech, which is, of all the parts of the convention, the one that is the most watched.
Right.
So I think that was valuable. But, you know, there are some advantages of getting the party faithful together and riling them up and, you know, getting them excited, and then all the connections that are formed. And not just for the presidential campaign, but for senatorial campaigns and congressional campaigns. There's a lot to do that, to be done. And those things are valuable. They're not news. They're out of the limelight. But you wonder if you need 4 days to do that, particularly in an era of the Internet and mm-hmm. easy communication and easy travel. I mean, far be it for me to tell the national parties how to do their conventions, but you wonder if maybe 2 days wouldn't be enough.
You know? They're expensive, too. If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're doing a little preview of the Democratic National Convention. Kicks off in earnest today. I'm talking with Jack Torrey, correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau, and also political scientist John Green of the University of Akron. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8255. 8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. We have an email from Christine in Columbus. She says, I heard a similar quote to what your guest was mentioning this morning on Morning Edition. The quote is, I've got a bumper sticker for you. Osama bin Laden is dead and GM is alive. It was from yesterday's Labor Day event in Detroit. So, an email from Marianne to both of you. Josh Mandel called U.S. Senate candidate called Sherrod Brown, Ohio's U.S. Senator, un-American. Amy Kramer told Soledad O'Brien she believes that President Obama doesn't love America the way we do. Are we returning to the times of Joe McCarthy? This whole Americanism has kind of popped up a lot lately. John Green, any thoughts?
Oh, it certainly has. I think it's part of the decreasing civility in American politics. That's not a new phenomenon. It's been happening for a while. Our political leaders and our activists don't deal with each other in a civil and effective fashion. And, you know, one of the very powerful ways to engage in uncivil conduct is to accuse people of not being loyal or not being legitimate. And, you know, one of the ways we do that is to say that people aren't American. You know, I think it's a very unfortunate thing because it really gets in the way of serious debate about where this country needs to go. But another thing is it makes it much, much more difficult for people to work together after the election. You know, if each side has basically questioned the patriotism and legitimacy of the other side, then how are they going to sit down and work out a deal on some of the really tough issues? So I think it's very, very unfortunate. This is probably not the worst time in American history, but it certainly has been getting worse over the last few years. And I don't know, Jack, what your reaction is, but I think this has been a much more uncivil campaign.
I think that when I first started covering politics, you know, a couple centuries ago, you did not directly accuse your opponent of being a liar. You would say something like, well, my opponent has mangled up the facts or, you know, done something that would fall short of it. Well, that's gone. Your opponent is a liar. The thing that bothered me about the un-American charge against Sherrod Brown is that came directly from the opposing candidate, as opposed to just, you know, a citizen thinking that Obama is un-American. I mean, Sherrod Brown is you could say a lot of things about Sherrod Brown, but for crying out loud, I mean, he hates the New York Yankees and he's a big Indians fan. I mean, you're an American citizen with that. And I don't. I think that type of rhetoric turns off the independent voters who decide the election. Now, it may be deliberate on their part. There may be a lot of candidates on either side who don't want the independents to show up because they don't know what they're going to do. And if you excite your base and you get enough of your base voters out, and the independents don't vote, you might win. But at the same time, as John just pointed out, they're going to have to govern after this election. At the end of this year, if Congress does nothing, taxes on everybody in the United States are going to go up, and federal spending is going to start dramatically being cut. And if there's a better formula for a recession, I haven't heard of it yet. So they're going to have to compromise. They're going to have to do things that they said in this campaign they will not do, because that's reality. I mean, George Mitchell, the former Senate Majority Leader, once told me, he said, you know, campaigns are about divisions, governing is about consensus. Well, we've got the divisions down pat now, but I don't know if we have the ability to forge any real consensus.
Do you think we'll hear Democrats suggesting that Republicans or Mitt Romney or Paul Ryan is un-American? Does it cut both ways?
I would be surprised, because I think they'll accuse them of you know, being less than candid with the truth. I think if you know it, you might see someone say that Ryan's Medicare idea is un-American. But the to me, that just doesn't sell well in a general campaign. I think you're much better off simply drawing the contrast and then telling people what you're going to do for the next 4 years.
You know, I don't think that we'll see the same kind of, you know, accusations of being un-American. Although, you know, we, as Jack pointed out, we mostly hear that from surrogates, not from the candidate itself. Mm-hmm. And that makes the Josh Mandel quote a little unusual. But I think there'll be plenty of negative comments about the Republicans, about not caring about the poor and not caring about the future and not caring about kids and not caring about old people. I mean, I think there'll be plenty of negative things. But again, I think the incivility will probably be from the surrogates and the party operatives, not from the candidates themselves, who, you know, particularly when they're giving a speech on national television, backlash is always a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I mean, I was at the 1992 Republican convention when Patrick Buchanan gave his famous culture war speech. And by being in the hall, I just sort of dismissed it. You know, that's typical Buchanan. He just, that same speech he's giving. People at home in their living rooms, however, this guy came across as this raging right-winger who they had never seen. I mean, TV is a cool medium, and it's tough to come across successfully hot in that. And as a result, that speech hurt the Republicans in that convention because it clearly sent a message that this was a very, very harsh culture war Republican Party, and it backfired. And that's why you won't see that kind of speech. You didn't really see that speech last week so much at the Republican convention. You certainly aren't going to see, I think, anything like that at the Democratic convention.
William, in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My comment is the Republicans made a comment that the president, they wanted the president to succeed, but if they really did, why did they sign the pledge not to work with them?
Okay, so you're saying this year the Republicans said but back in 2008 they signed a pledge saying that they
would not work
with the president. Jack Tory, what about that? Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I don't recall that specifically. But I mean, look, the reality is, political, the minority party, its job, the opposing party, its job is to oppose. You know, if a president wants to pass a health care law that the Republicans think is a bad idea, they have two choices. They can either figure out a way to compromise to moderate the law and then pass it, which is what normally would happen, or they simply vote against it. And in 2010, they just voted against it en masse. Now, they didn't have the votes to defeat it. It became the law of the land. What is lacking today is the ability to say, okay, we want to accomplish our program, you want to accomplish your program. What is there that we both agree on that we can pass? And that just simply there is no middle anymore to accomplish that. The first year I was in Washington, they passed the 1990 revisions of the Clean Air Act, which was going to control the type of pollutants that caused acid rain. The bill that was on the floor was the Bob Dole, George Mitchell bill. And it was backed by Republican President George H.W. Bush. You wouldn't have that today. There would be no such thing. But that's because the times were a little bit easier. The two political parties were not as fractured. And you had people like Bob Dole and George Mitchell who were master legislators and wanted to accomplish something. I don't see anybody in the current Senate today who has their ability, and so they're very good at just stopping things and having big arguments.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. so, you know, that's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday. Back in the day, novelists unveiled their stories little by little in serial form. Hear how technology may bring that trend back in vogue. That's on Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 75 degrees with showers today, possibly a thunderstorm this afternoon, a high of 81. There's a chance of rain for tonight, a low of 68 degrees. Some fog Wednesday morning, sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 88. And a chance of rain still Wednesday night, a low of 67. Support for 89.7 comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, presenting Hal Holbrook in Mark Twain Tonight. Hal Holbrook performs his one-man show, delivering a rambling, intelligent, and comedic monologue with material derived from Mark Twain's historians. Thursday, September 20th, at the McCoy Center in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the Democratic National Convention to kick off today in Charlotte, North Carolina, with Jack Torrey of the Columbus Dispatch and also University of Akron political scientist John Green. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. In 2008, then vice presidential nominee Joe Biden made his case for an Obama administration. Let's hear.
With Barack Obama as our president, they'll look at us again. They'll trust us again, and we'll be able to lead again.
So when I listened back to his speech, I was somewhat nonplussed. What do we expect this time around from Joe Biden? John Green?
Well, you know, the vice presidential candidates have a really important role, which is that in some sense they're the aggressors in presidential campaigns. And, you know, we saw Paul Ryan do that a little bit of that last week when he spoke at the Republican convention. Of course, he also had the additional burden of introducing himself to the country. People pretty much know Joe Biden because he's been vice president for a while. So he, you know, I think we'll hear some very strong arguments about why Obama should be reelected and why the Republicans are not a good choice. But, you know, the other problem that a vice presidential candidate has is they can't upstage the person at the top of the ticket. So those have to be very carefully crafted speeches. You know, Vice President Biden can give a good speech, but what he has to be careful about is ad-libbing, because he occasionally gets himself in trouble when he goes off script.
Right. Do you think he'll be pretty carefully scripted, Jack?
Yes, he will be very carefully scripted. But that doesn't necessarily stop Biden. I mean,
exactly.
The reason reporters love covering him, because he's liable to just pop off and say something really off message. But, boy, I'll tell you what, these things are so well scripted. They're looking at the teleprompter. They're supposed to follow it exactly. And he's going to, you know, my guess is he's going to do the job that's, you know, he will simultaneously take, you know, take a meat cleaver to Mitt Romney while talking about the fact that the world, the survival of the American economy depended on Barack Obama in 2009. And my guess is it'll be a well-received, hard-hitting speech. I will be stunned if he goes off message and makes, you know, one of his cracks, which is why, you know, I mean, he's fun to cover, because as the old line, I think it was from Michael Kinsley, a gaffe in Washington is when you inadvertently tell the truth.
You know, there'll be another interesting thing on Thursday night before the president speaks is John Kerry, the Democratic nominee in 2004, mm-hmm. and something of an expert on foreign policy, is going to be speaking as well. And, you know, I think there's that's going to be an interesting speech to watch as well, because you could imagine, and I haven't seen the speech, but I can imagine that Senator Kerry would sort of take on the foreign policy criticism of the Republicans, and Biden would take on the domestic policy, you know, and then they'd be ready for the president to deliver the positive message of what the next administration is going to try to accomplish.
You know, I just skimmed the list of speakers that's planned for the convention this week, and I didn't see any Clint Eastwood types in that list. Now, Clint Eastwood, of course, was a surprise speaker, so there may be surprise speakers at the Democratic convention as well, but there wasn't a lot of Hollywood in this list. Am I right, Jack Tory, or did I miss something?
I haven't seen a lot of Hollywood. I mean, I saw, you know, like I said, Ashley Judd this morning, and I was somewhat being frivolous. She actually gave a terrific speech this morning. It was very eloquent, exceptionally well delivered, as it should be, because she is an actress, and it touched on issues of the new healthcare law, the economy, and abortion rights, and the delegates just loved it. But I have not seen any prominent roles for Hollywood stars. I know they're here at the convention, but I haven't seen anything like that. I mean, this is Barack Obama's convention. This mm-hmm. is his party, his convention, his message, and he's going to, his themes are going to dominate throughout this the next 3 days here.
You know, in that regard, one of the really interesting things is that former President Clinton is going to be speaking mm-hmm. on Wednesday night. And, you know, there had been some speculation early on that, you know, the president wouldn't want to have a competition because, you know, the President Clinton is still very popular, particularly among Democrats, but even in the country as a whole. So I thought that was really pretty interesting. Of course, from a political point of view, it's hard to think of somebody other than perhaps the president himself who would be as good as at mobilizing the Democratic faithful as Bill Clinton.
Now, of course, Hillary Clinton, who's a big favorite, can't speak at the convention. Is that right, Jack?
It's usually considered secretaries of the Defense and State and Treasury are usually considered the nonpartisan types of offices. If I'm not mistaken, she's out of the country right now.
Right.
And so you almost never see I can't recall seeing a Secretary of State delivering a speech because it's considered a nonpartisan type of position.
Now, I, again, just skimmed the list, but what I did see from Ohio was former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland and also candidate for Congress Joyce Beatty from, of course, Central Ohio. What do we expect from Ted Strickland, or what should we expect, John Green?
Well, you know, I think that Ted Strickland will talk a lot about the economy. Of course, he had some difficulties with the economy in 2010 when he wasn't reelected, but I think he's in a position to talk about that from firsthand experience, but also criticize John Kasich. And remember, at the Republican convention, there was sort of the Kasich speech,
mm-hmm.
Which was, I think, Jack, one of the other unscripted moments, but that wasn't why, you know, trying not to get the governor scripted, but there was the Ohio story, and you know that somehow Republican policies are working in Ohio. I think Governor Strickland's in a position to rebut that and criticize it.
I think you're right. The problem is, boy, you talk about a twisted pretzel explanation. I mean, Ohio's economy is booming, but it has nothing to do with John Kasich. It has everything to do with Barack Obama, even though Mitt Romney has pointed to. I mean, you just, you know, to me. If you're the Democrats, you simply say, look at what's going on in Ohio, okay? Look what we've done there. And the fact of the matter is, what's happened in Ohio has been a long time coming. Throughout the past 30 years, Ohio companies have increased their productivity. They're producing a lot more with less. They've transformed themselves into a far more complex economy. Places like the Cleveland Clinic and University Hospitals, which, you know, barely registered a blip 30 years ago are now the dominant employers in the state. But you can't separate the auto bailout from that. The auto bailout, without the auto bailout, if Chrysler and General Motors had gone under, I don't think anybody could say that would have been a good thing for Ohio.
Right, and speaking of tortured explanations, that's something that the Republicans are having a hard time wrapping their brain around when it comes to Ohio.
Well, because they opposed it.
Right.
Now they're trying to figure out how to say, well, I really wasn't too much against it. I was just, you know, I mean, Rob Portman is the one who came up with probably the best formulation, which is not surprising because he's one of the smartest people in the Ohio delegation. He just said, well, I think they negotiated a bad deal for Ohio and its workers, but he's never said he opposed the bailout.
Mm-hmm. It could have been better.
He could have been better.
Yeah.
By contrast, Mitt Romney is on record. He wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which he talked about an orderly bankruptcy. And the headline, which Romney did not write, but which has been used to pummel him, said, "Let Detroit go bankrupt." And Ann is a former reporter. You know, sometimes headline writers do cause the writer a little bit of grief.
Mm-hmm.
and in this case, it has caused him some grief. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the Republicans, for the large part, were opposed to it. President Bush wanted to bail out the auto industry. President Obama wanted to do it. But there's a very strong section of the Republican Party that believes in free markets, period, end of discussion. And they don't like these kinds of bailouts on philosophical reasons. Well, that's fine, but go explain that to an unemployed auto worker, because you know you said it's better for him to let the company go broke.
And then there's also the bailout of the banks to mm-hmm. compare it with.
Well, and in fairness, the money to bail out the banks was pushed through by President Bush.
Right, but Republicans.
Yes, and John Boehner and Paul Ryan and a lot of Republicans voted for that. And Rob Portman in a TV interview on CNN at the time said, yes, we need to pass this. I mean, there comes a time where if you're going to allow the economy to flourish, you have to put aside all your ideological ideas and simply do what is necessary. So to me, I don't know how the Republicans win the bailout argument unless the only way they win is if GM files for bankruptcy in the next 3 weeks.
and let's hope that doesn't happen.
No kidding.
But you know, another point, you were talking about Joyce Beatty.
Yeah.
One of the things that happens at national conventions is the party tries to highlight their rising stars, and partly to help those people along, because that's the farm team for the future for the party, but also to accentuate the themes that the party's trying to put forward. And Joyce Beatty is a good example of that. I mean, here's a African-American candidate for Congress.
Who's almost surely going to get elected because of the makeup of her district.
Exactly. And so that I think that works both for her and for the party as a whole.
We have an email from Joe. He writes, "I think hearing Bill Clinton talk is going to make me wish he was president again, back when the deficit was in control and things seemed less intense." That's an interesting way to talk about him, less intense, just kind of people can relax a little bit.
John, do you want to take a crack at that one?
Well, you know, the economy was certainly a better back then, and Democrats and particularly President Clinton would like to take some credit for that. And maybe that's valid. Maybe it had to do with other circumstances. Who knows? And, you know, when the economy is bad, it puts pressure on lots of things, including politics itself. So I think, you know, things really were a good bit better economically when Clinton was president. But remember, a lot of the divisiveness that we have today really ramped up in Clinton's second term with mm-hmm. the effort to impeach him and so forth. So, you know, maybe things are hotter today, but they were pretty hot back when President Clinton was in office.
I agree. Clinton can eloquently make the case about how Obama needs more time to continue the economic recovery. There is a slight chance that people will react the way the person who just emailed reacted. Oh, gee, I wish, you know, he were running for a third term.
The good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. But the fact of the matter is most people, you know, most Democrats and some independents will look at Clinton and say he's making a good point. Clinton was a master at expanding the Democratic base to win the votes of independents. And it's been one of the things that Obama has, in my judgment, has never been as skillful as doing. I mean, Clinton was able to go into the South where he was from and talk in a way that, you know, didn't that Southern voters could relate to. Which is why he was able to carry a number of Southern states and break the Republican electoral monopoly in 1992 and 1996. So I think that's a big plus. I suppose, you know, there'll be, you know, parsings of the speech. Well, he didn't say Obama's name enough, or he didn't do this, or he didn't do that. But that's the type of thing that interests political scientists and reporters. I don't think the average voter cares about that.
McCain was in Ohio as Obama spoke last in 4 years ago. And after a pretty negative period in that election cycle, the McCain's campaign aired a one-night advertisement that complimented Barack Obama and noted the timing of the speech on the anniversary of a famous Martin Luther King address. He said in the ad, "Senator Obama, this is truly a good day for America. Too often the achievements of our opponents go unnoticed, so I wanted to stop and say congratulations. How perfect that your nomination would come on this historic day. Tomorrow we'll be back at it. But tonight, Senator, job well done." Was that unusual? And do you think anything like that might happen this year, John Green?
It is unusual, and I don't expect anything like that to happen this year. But, you know, I think an awful lot of people, whatever their partisanship might be, would welcome that kind of positive comment. And, you know, there was something historic about the first African-American running for president and perhaps winning and going to the White House. And I think it was very gratifying that to a lot of people that Senator McCain recognized that. And it would be wonderful if we had a moment like that. And I don't know what it would be, but it would be one of those things. You know, it goes back to what one of the previous callers said. You know, our leaders and our voters really do wish the country well. But sometimes that gets all caught up in trying to win. And then we don't do the positive things or say the positive things that help to bring us together.
Jack Torrey, any parting thoughts?
No, I'm looking forward to the next 3 days to see if they can, you know, if they will stick to their script. I'm going to probably look at it with a little bit of nostalgia because I seriously think in 4 years a lot of news organizations are going to question putting people in here for 4 and 5 days. And my guess is the parties will sit there and say, we can do this in 1 or 2 days.
Well, speaking of that, of course, the big broadcast networks, NBC, ABC, and CBS, are not airing much of the conventions. They didn't last week. However, PBS and NPR have been airing much of the conventions tonight. It began at 8 p.m. tonight on WOSU-TV and also 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/campaign2012. You can get full coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jack Torrey, thanks for joining us today.
Well, I was glad to do it.
Jack Torrey is correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Washington Bureau. And John Green, thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Political scientist John Green, director of the Racy Bliss Institute of Applied Politics at the University of Akron. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.